Hello, students. My name is Mike Estefan, and I thank you for joining me on this month's deep dive episode on the EM Clerkship Podcast. This month's episode will be covering ethylene glycol toxicity. But before we get into it, I actually have an apology to make on behalf of EM Clerkship. On our website, which is www.emclerkship.com, there's a web form where you are able to contact us directly and send us messages and comments. Nobody ever used it, or so we thought. We just found out the other week that there was a glitch with this, and we were simply just unable to see the comments that you guys were writing us. All of a sudden, we're able to see years of questions, comments, and feedback that we could not see prior to last week. So on behalf of myself, Zach, and Maddie, we want to apologize to all the listeners who took the time to reach out to us. Some of the comments were truly heartfelt, and we do not want you to think we are ignoring you. I think Zach was able to get it up and running, so we shouldn't have any more issues in the future. Now, before we begin this episode, just a quick word from our sponsors over at Pearson Ravitz Insurance. Pearson Ravitz is my own personal disability insurance broker. I have own occupation disability insurance, which means if I become disabled just enough to not be able to perform my duties as an ER physician, I will receive disability benefits. This is different than your run-of-the-mill disability insurance, which will only really cover you if you are disabled to the point of being unable to perform any work. Getting own occupation disability insurance as a physician is really important. And the best part is, if you sign up as a resident, you keep that lower rate even once you become an attending. It would be a mistake to wait until you're an attending to sign up. Don't wait until it's too late. Check out Pearson Ravitz at www.pearsonravitz.com and schedule a consultation appointment today. Don't forget to mention EM Clerkship if you do. And now, back to our episode. Ethylene glycol toxicity. You might go your entire career without seeing a case of this, but it is important to consider and to recognize, especially for board exams. We'll start with a general overview of ethylene glycol toxicity and then move into the clinical presentation. Next, we'll have a discussion on how to diagnose ethylene glycol ingestions, and finally, we'll wrap it all up with a discussion on the treatment. Ethylene glycol is classically found in antifreeze or brake fluid, and sometimes in different paints and solvents. So, it's around the house. Serum levels of ethylene glycol peak just a couple hours after ingestion, and then ethylene glycol begins getting broken down into its toxic metabolites. The body breaks down ethylene glycol using the enzyme alcohol dehydrogenase. This is relevant later. There are two clinically relevant toxic metabolites of ethylene glycol, and these are glycolic acid and oxalic acid. These two metabolites, along with ethylene glycol itself, are directly responsible for the three distinct phases of ethylene glycol intoxication. The three phases include the CNS phase, the cardiopulmonary phase, and the renal phase. Let's break this down. Phase 1, again, is the CNS phase. The symptoms during the CNS phase are due to ethylene glycol itself. Again, serum levels peak just a couple hours after ingestion, and then they begin to decline, with most ethylene glycol being metabolized within the first 12 hours. These patients are essentially just drunk during this phase. They appear clinically intoxicated. So, slurred speech, ataxia, confusion or decreased GCS. You know, sometimes they'll have some nausea and vomiting, as we do see with alcohol intoxication. And then rarely, these patients can have a seizure. I like to think of this as the drunk phase, simply put. Now, ethylene glycol first gets broken down into glycolic acid, which is responsible for phase 2. Phase 2 is the cardiopulmonary phase. And again, these symptoms are due to the first metabolite, glycolic acid, which is directly toxic to the heart and to the lungs. This phase begins around the 12-hour mark, and symptoms progressively increase in severity as time goes on and as more glycolic acid accumulates. Symptoms here are variable, but it essentially causes complete myocardial dysfunction. It can lead to congestive heart failure, with or without pulmonary edema and hypoxemia. It can lead to hypotension due to cardiogenic shock. It can lead to cardiac dysrhythmias. It can lead to ARDS as a possibility due to direct pulmonary toxicity, etc., etc. I like to think of this as the heart failure stage, again, simplifying it. Now, glycolic acid is further broken down into oxalic acid, which is responsible for phase 3. Phase 3, the renal phase. As glycolic acid is metabolized and broken down, oxalic acid begins to form, and this is around the 24 to 48 hour mark. Oxalic acid can then bind to calcium in the bloodstream that has the direct effect of causing hypocalcemia. However, the bigger problem is that calcium oxalate can then precipitate out of the blood and form crystal deposits, specifically in the kidney, ultimately leading to renal failure. Symptoms usually start out with some flank pain and some hematuria, and eventually progress to anuria and total renal failure. And along with the renal failure, you get all the associated complications, like hyperkalemia, uremic encephalopathy, volume overload, etc., etc. I think of this phase as like a super kidney stone that completely kills the kidneys and causes renal failure. So real quick, let's simplify this so it's easy to remember. There are three phases. Phase 1 is due to ethylene glycol itself, and you can think of this as the drunk phase. Phase 2 is due to glycolic acid itself, and you can think of this as the CHF or ARDS phase. Phase 3 is due to oxalic acid itself, and I think of this phase as a super kidney stone that causes renal failure. Okay, so we got the clinical presentation down. Let's move on and talk about diagnosis. I already talked about this a bit during this month's case, but I want to revisit it. There are essentially three ways to diagnose ethylene glycol ingestion, and all of them importantly involve having a very high index of suspicion. Especially if you have a patient who is clinically intoxicated, but they have a low or normal ethanol level, or they're just not sobering up like you would expect. So the three ways to diagnose ethylene glycol toxicity include 1, obtaining an ethylene glycol level directly. 2, calculating an elevated osmolar gap. And 3, measuring serial anion gaps. Let's break each one of these down. First is by obtaining a direct ethylene glycol level in the blood. This is great, as it can be pretty damn specific and sensitive. The problem is it is usually a send-out test. And even if you can run the test in-house, it often takes numerous hours to result. Practically, you need to start treatment before you have this back. So, while it's a great confirmatory test, it is not super helpful for us in the ED. The second method is the method we've probably all learned. This is the elevated osmolar gap. Essentially, you use a long-ass formula to calculate what we call a calculated serum osmolality, and you subtract that from the measured serum osmolality to determine what is called the osmolar gap. Normal osmolar gap is between 10 and 20, though different sources will give you different numbers, and any higher than that in the right clinical scenario suggests a toxic alcohol ingestion. Now, there are a lot of problems with this method. The major problem up front is that only ethylene glycol itself contributes to the elevated osmolar gap. And what I mean by that is that as ethylene glycol is broken down into glycolic acid and eventually oxalic acid, the osmolar gap normalizes, and the accumulation of those two toxic metabolites leads to an elevated anion gap. So essentially, right after ingestion, and for the first 4-6 hours or so, you will have a very high osmolar gap because you will have a high level of ethylene glycol in the blood. As time goes on and ethylene glycol has broken down into oxalic acid and glycolic acid, the osmolar gap will rapidly decrease while the anion gap rapidly increases. They're inversely related. So if your patient shows up at hour 16 after ingestion, you may calculate a normal osmolar gap for that patient, but that certainly does not rule out ethylene glycol ingestion. There are other problems with the osmolar gap method too, and Scott Weingart from MCRIT actually did a really nice review on why the osmolar gap sucks, which I'll link in the show notes. But to summarize, there are a ton of different equations that one can use to calculate the calculated serum osmolality, as well as a ton of different ranges for what a normal osmolar gap is. So essentially, there is no standardization here, which leads to poor sensitivity. In addition to that, there are a lot of substances or physiologic states which can cause an elevated osmolar gap, which then leads to a poor specificity. This leads us to the third method, which Scott Weingart of MCRIT really seems to favor, and it makes sense. Serial anion gap measurements. The anion gap will always be elevated in an ethylene glycol ingestion, and it will usually begin rapidly increasing around hour 6. It is also quite easy for us to assess for and rule out other causes of an elevated anion gap. Anyone remember mud piles? So, in summary, this method seems to be my favorite. It's probably the least quote-unquote official, but in reality, there's no real official method to diagnosing ethylene glycol ingestion. I mean, sure, getting the blood test back is great, but for us in the ER, when we don't have that kind of time, we often have to make this diagnosis based on a combination of factors and not based on one specific test result. So I think the combination of using the osmolar gap as well as serial anion gap measurements in the setting of having a suspicion for ethylene glycol ingestion is probably the best way to go about diagnosing it while in the ED. And I know I'm beating a dead horse here, but it is so important. You must have a high index of suspicion here. Most of the time you're going to have to treat without having that confirmatory blood level. Speaking of treating, let's move on and talk about how we manage these patients clinically. There are essentially two main treatments that you need to know as a community ED doc, and a couple other bonus treatments that will earn you style points, but I'm not sure if they really have any proven efficacy. Treatment number one, you have to block alcohol dehydrogenase. Again, remember that ethylene glycol is broken down into its toxic metabolites by the enzyme alcohol dehydrogenase. Fomepizole is the drug of choice here, which inhibits alcohol dehydrogenase, and the sooner you give it, the more efficacious it will be. Now, if your hospital does not have fomepizole, you can actually use ethanol medically to help facilitate this blockade. Ethanol will compete with ethylene glycol for that enzyme, thus slowing down the metabolism of ethylene glycol into its toxic metabolites of glycolic acid and oxalic acid. The second main treatment is hemodialysis. This will directly remove ethylene glycol as well as its toxic metabolites from the bloodstream, and it has the added bonus of correcting acidosis, correcting electrolyte abnormalities, and correcting volume overload. Indications for dialysis include your usual AEIOU, so acidosis, electrolyte abnormalities, toxic ingestion, volume overload, and complications of uremia. Now, these are the main two treatments that you need to know. As I said earlier, there's a couple, what I'll call bonus treatments, that I had found online reading a couple review articles. They seem not to have great evidence behind them, but they make sense physiologically, so we're going to talk about them. The first one I want to talk about is a bicarbonate drip. This may help as a bridge to dialysis. Theoretically, it may correct the serum pH if the patient is able to compensate respiratory-wise and can blow off the extra CO2 that they will generate from the bicarbonate drip. Typically, if I were to do this, I would use isotonic bicarbonate which is a liter of D5W with 3 amps of CodeCart bicarbonate. The other two quote-unquote bonus treatments include pyridoxine and thiamine. And the reason for this is that these vitamins are cofactors to the other enzymes that help break down glycolic acid and oxalic acid. So theoretically, this may help if your patient happens to be deficient in pyridoxine or thiamine, which a lot of patients who are drinking ethylene glycol probably are. And that is all I have for you guys today. Let's summarize the entire episode. Ethylene glycol is a substance found in brake fluid and antifreeze that gets metabolized into two very toxic metabolites, glycolic acid and oxalic acid. Ethylene glycol toxicity presents in three distinct phases. Phase 1, the CNS phase. This occurs during the first 12 hours after ingestion and is due to ethylene glycol itself. Think of this phase as the drunk phase. These patients have ataxia, slurred speech, decreased GCS, and sometimes can develop seizures. Phase 2 is the cardiopulmonary phase, and this occurs around the 12 to 24 hour mark and is due to glycolic acid. Think of this phase as the acute CHF phase. These patients can go into cardiogenic shock, they can develop pulmonary edema, they can become hypotensive, they can go into cardiac dysrhythmias, etc., etc. Phase 3, the renal phase. This occurs around the 24 to 48 hour mark and is due to oxalic acid. Think of this phase as the super kidney stone phase, as I like to call it. These patients develop severe flank pain with hematuria and eventually develop renal failure. Diagnosis is largely made by having a high index of suspicion. I can't say it enough. Send off a toxic alcohol panel as soon as possible. Consider using osmolar gap and serial anion gaps to help boost your index of suspicion. Look out for other non-specific, quote-unquote, signs of ethylene glycol ingestion, such as hypocalcemia or the presence of calcium oxalate crystals in the urine. Remember, you're usually going to have to treat without having a confirmatory diagnosis. And always think of this if you have a patient who is clinically intoxicated, but they have a low or normal ethanol level. Treatment is with fomepizole as soon as possible, followed by hemodialysis if indicated. Remember, AEIOU. You can use ethanol as a substitute for fomepizole if your hospital does not have it. Bonus points for starting a bicarbonate drip while waiting for dialysis, and for repleting the enzyme cofactors like pyridoxine and thiamine. Thanks for tuning in. As always, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or feedback. My email is mike@emclerkship.com. And until next month's case, keep working hard, keep studying, and be sure to enjoy your shift.